Good morning, me. It's Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 13:10 a.m. More snow. Nothing new here.
Nope.
Saturday, February 21st.
Yeah.
We're almost out of February. The only benefit is it's a short month, right? 28 days?
Yeah, that's the only benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What a show we have today.
Big one.
We've got a big show. Later on this hour, who do we have, Deb?
Sylvia Getman.
She is the president and CEO of the Aroostook Medical Center. Fascinating discussion, fascinating guest. Many interesting ideas in terms of medicine and healthcare here in Maine. We'll get to that in about 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Anything new going on with you?
No, just more shoveling and plowing and scraping. And
really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we last spoke, you were heading out to see 50 Shades of Grey. How was that?
You mean you were?
No. No.
Did you go?
No, I haven't seen that.
Oh, no.
How about you?
No.
Shani?
No, I have not.
Yeah. There you go. None of us have seen it, or at least we're not saying.
are these theatrical choices, morality choices?
I'm not even sure what it's about, to be honest with you.
Did they reach enough shades of gray for you? Do you need more, less? Is 50 enough? What was the issue?
Well, I did see some of the previews, and it looks very intimate.
Right.
Any plans, you guys, to see it?
No.
Bring your sweetie with you?
Cuddle?
Cuddle?
Is that one of the shades of gray? I don't know if that's one of the shades. No, I got no interest. Did you read my column in this week's forecast?
I have not read it yet.
Shani McShani, have you seen it?
I did, yes.
Okay.
Do share.
I brought up a couple things. One, probably 2 or 3 days a week, I drop Zach off at school in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I went on a rant in my column against parents, moms and dads, who, especially in cold weather when there's snow, they pull up to the drop-off area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's like, you know, if it's at 7:45 or 7:50, you've got a bunch of cars all lined up to do the same thing. And they pull up to the front, and then while you're stuck behind waiting to drop your kid off, the mom or the dad and the kid start talking about, you know, hey, what are you doing today? Or what time should I pick you up? And that goes on for like a minute, and cars are beeping and things are happening. And then the kid gets out and he gets his backpack out of the back and he's counting to see if he got 4 cookies or 5. And I want to get out of the car and just, you know, you don't want to do that in a school environment because then you're that parent.
Yeah, that's bad.
So I came up with a new list of rules.
Okay.
The rules are when a parent is dropping their kid off 300 yards out, they've got to figure out their after-school plans. 200 yards out, they've got to review any kind of dietary nutritional information. 100 yards out, a quick, hey, I love you, have a nice day. And by the time you get up to the drop-off thing, it should be like a NASCAR pit stop.
Yes.
You pull up, the kid jumps out, and then everything is fine.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second rant I went into, and if anyone wants to go pick up a forecast or it's in there or go online, is Sports Illustrated bathing suit issue.
Why?
Did you read it this week? Did you see it?
No.
Shani McShani, you see it?
Is it too much?
Yeah, for me it was too much, not necessarily in kind of this parochial, puritanical, but they've gone too far with commercializing it and exploiting it, and it started in, I think, 1964 when it was like a 5-page section in Sports Illustrated. And then a couple of decades ago, they made it its entire section.
Mm-hmm.
And the current issue has 214 pictures of bathing suit models. And the problem is, you know, they've gone from like, you know, kind of clever bathing suits to painted on bathing suits.
Oh.
And now one of the pictures was a girl where she was just sitting there, you know, as we would say in the South, naked.
Yeah.
And there was a bathing suit, but it was sitting 2 feet away from her on the dock.
Oh, my.
So technically, it was a bathing suit shoot. But
yes.
I think they make more money on that issue than almost every other issue combined. And the problem is they've got 51 issues a year purporting to be a sports magazine. And then they kind of slip this in as their big money maker.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So I canceled my subscription.
Well, good for you.
I said, it's just, you know, It's 2015. We don't need to exploit people. It's not cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, we only have a couple minutes. Let's. What's happening on this day? Do we have anything good? On this day, February 21st in 1948, NASCAR was incorporated. People may not know that NASCAR stands for National Association of Stock Car Auto Racing. You know, I spent a lot of time at NASCAR.
Yes.
Yeah. I work with Miller Brewing Company and work with Levi Strauss and manage sponsorships.
Mm-hmm.
For many years, we worked with Jimmy Johnson,
That's
who
right.
was a 5- or 6-time NASCAR champion.
Yep.
Great guy. And so there, in fact, the Daytona 500 takes place this next weekend.
Yeah.
Birthdays, Olympia Snow, former U.S. Senator. She turns 68.
68.
Wish her the best on her birthday today, born in 1947.
Yep.
1934, Ruth McClanahan.
Rue.
Who passed away, Rue.
Thank you for being brave.
Golden yeah. Girls.
There you go.
She was Blanche, right, on Golden Girls?
Yeah. Yep.
That was yep. one of your favorite shows for both of you, right?
I love it.
You still love it.
I still do. I watch it reruns all the time.
There you go.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You know who amazes me? And I don't think she was on this show, but she keeps popping up everywhere is Betty White.
She was on Golden Girls.
She was on this too.
Oh, yes. She played the
I think she was on
Rose,
Saturday Night yeah. Live. And it's like I was on a plane once and I sat one seat away from Betty White.
Oh,
and you would think crazy. It was like, you know, Mick Jagger was on the plane.
Oh, she's amazing.
She is.
And she just keeps ticking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She just in
She
I don't know.
Better with age.
She's just got all the credit in the world to Betty Wright. Well, that's on this day. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Why don't we play the interview, which we did just a few days ago, with Sylvia Getman. She's president and CEO of Aroostook Medical Center up north, as they say, and I think their main facility is in Presque Isle. Fascinating interview, and then we will go in the second hour at 12:06. Who we got at 12:06?
Joel Johnson.
We talk about Maine's economy, a fun animated discussion. Thanks for listening, and here's the interview. Welcome back. Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Please join me in welcoming our special guest, Sylvia Getman, who is president and CEO of the Aroostook Medical Center, known up north as TAMIC. How are you doing today, Sylvia?
Fantastic. Pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. And with the theme song, although apparently you are not a doctor, you are the leading force, the president and CEO of one of our major medical centers here in Maine. So really exciting to talk about medicine and healthcare and servicing the community up north.
Well, some of my favorite topics.
Oh, absolutely. Let's start a little bit. I'd like to just get a little bit of background in terms of where you grew up, went to school, and how you ended up here in Maine.
Yeah, and you know, that's often one of the hardest questions I have to answer for people because my father was career military, and my mother's actually from Italy. And so uh-huh. I kind of grew up here, there, and everywhere. But I love the T-shirt. I don't actually have it, but I want it that says, I'm not from Maine, but I got here as soon as I could. It just took some of us a little longer to find our way
here. We talk
here.
About that all the time, this whole provincial thing of, you're not from here. And I think anyone who makes the decision to be here, we should be celebrated, not, you know, there shouldn't be any kind of negative connotation. So.
I don't know. For me, it's always been a comfortable place to be because I've always been from somewhere else.
Right.
You know, so I went to 6 different grade schools and on a couple different continents. So I don't mind that at all. But I'm absolutely glad that I ended up here in Maine.
So is Missouri where you grew up? Is that was the base camp or where was the what state do you recognize as the most significant in terms of your childhood growing up?
Yeah. So I'm a Badger. So Wisconsin is where my father retired to. That's where his family was. I'll claim Wisconsin for roots and the Midwest probably even more generally than that.
You've got a little bit of Iowa there. You've
yeah.
got
all the good stuff.
Those yeah. are good places. You know, it's the kind of place, Iowa. I've spent some time in Davenport. You know, it's part of the Quad Cities. Shani, can you name the other three?
Oh, put me on the spot. No, I can't.
Really? I can. I can go Davenport, Moline.
Bettendorf.
Bettendorf. And,
yeah, it's like the Seven Dwarfs. I'm going to leave one out. Yeah.
Well, it's the Tri-Cities as far as we're concerned today. Davenport's part of Tri-Cities. So talk about in terms of your career, in terms of I see here that at one point you were CEO of Nantucket Cottage Hospital.
That's absolutely correct.
Is Nantucket Cottage Hospital happen to be on Nantucket?
On the island of Nantucket.
One of the best places in the whole world. I was there last year.
Yep, other than Maine. Yeah.
Yes, that's what I meant. Thank you for adding that asterisk. Talk me a little bit about your experience in Nantucket. The hospital in the service area was, you know, I'm guessing business picked up in the summer. During the winter months, the population is relatively small. But talk about that experience.
Oh, absolutely. It was a fantastic place to do health care. Interesting in a lot of different ways. If you can imagine providing health care 30 miles at sea. And a small hospital, but the population swings were pretty remarkable. A little bit like Bar Harbor. Right. So population swinging to probably about 50, 60,000 in the summer. And the year-round population, about 10,000. So very, very busy emergency room, as you can imagine. Great connectivity. It was remote. Obviously, I have a fondness for remote and rural in general for some reasons that we can talk about later. But there's probably about 25, 26 days of the year where nothing goes on or off the island because of weather and fog and other issues. So a really great, resilient team that could kind of take care of whatever walked in the door and did it really, really well. And so a great group to lead in healthcare.
Talk a little bit about your career path as the administrator of these large, currently TAMIC, the Aroostook Medical Center, and prior to that, a number of different health centers and hospitals. That the juxtaposition between your role as an administrator and being non-medical personnel and that of how hospitals or medical centers are organized with chief of staff or somebody who has more of a pure medical oversight and how those roles kind of interconnect both where you are currently at TAMIC and in general in the industry, the separation of administration versus medicine.
Yeah, and interesting that you call it separation because I absolutely don't. To me, it's a partnership, and I am not a clinician by training. I've been around healthcare quite a bit. My mother volunteered with the Red Cross, was a gray lady back when that was a thing. My brother's in hospital administration. My sister's a medical technologist, so I was in and around that environment quite a bit. But absolutely, I'm business trained. I have my Master's of Science in Business, which I think is the only thing probably worse than an MBA, because I do like the data side and the technical side and the planning part of that. But what it has led me to be able to do is really take what I feel is the best of training in the business side of healthcare and partner it in a really new and interesting way with the best of clinical leadership and specifically physician leadership. And we have a thing at the Aroostook Medical Center, and it's language that's being used a lot called a dyad, which is just how do you partner the best of professional management with the best of clinical leadership and knowledge and do it at a very different different way and different level. And kind of easy for me to do, only in that I need my clinical colleagues. I need their voice. I don't even play a physician, you know, on TV. I am a parent, so, you know, some of us think that enables us to make some diagnoses. But I really rely on and work, I think, very well with my clinical colleagues.
Well, I absolutely believe, and I think it's great to kind of position it as a partnership, but when somebody has to make the final decision relative to the hospital, how does the hierarchy, whether it's a financial decision or a staff or a labor decision, is the president CEO, does the buck stop there, or are there different elements of oversight from medicine to administration?
Yeah, and all of those things because, you know, healthcare has to be kind of ridiculously complicated. But certainly the accountability stops with me and the responsibility stops with me. And I take that responsibility both as an employer and as a healthcare provider very seriously. Having said that, I learned a long time ago from some great mentors that what you do is you share the wins. Right. And you hold the accountability for the losses. And happily, we haven't had that many losses. At TAMIC, we talk about leadership as a team sport, and we do it very much as a team. You have to in order to really get the best voices and the best leadership. But certainly when things don't go as anticipated, that's on me.
Great. We have Sylvia Gettman here. She is the president and CEO of the Roostic Medical Center, also known as TAMIC, up north. Live up in Mars Hill, Maine?
I absolutely do.
Fantastic. Let's talk about TAMIC. Let's talk about, for people in our listening audience here in southern Maine, they may not be familiar with the size and the scope and the servicing, but talk a little bit about both the facility and kind of the institution as a healthcare institution and the, not the market area, but the residential area that you serve and the scope of services that are handled there versus things that may have to be referred down to Maine Med or some other other healthcare locations.
Yeah, we actually are a rather large entity, even for the state of Maine. So interestingly enough, we're the 25th largest employer in the state of Maine, which we can talk later is probably not a really great thing, but it is. We are the largest employer in Aroostook County. We have about 1,000 employees. And we service a group of patients that covers a pretty broad geography, about 70,000. Again, a lot of people know somewhat dwindling as the demographics change. It's a very old population, a very high percentage over the age of 65. It's a economically disadvantaged area to a certain extent. Oddly, if you're in healthcare, that's where you want to practice, right? Because that's where people need you the most. I've had the benefit of working with an organization that really had a far-seeing board of directors, community members from across the entire county that made a decision quite a while ago that said, we can do it brilliantly, if we can do it well, and it keeps people from having to travel when that may be disadvantageous for their health, we will make the commitment to do it here, even if we don't make money at that particular service. So the Aroostook Medical Center, and you know, a lot of people hear about primary care, and they don't know that we have like four tiers of care: primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. And luckily, it stops there because I don't know what word would come after quaternary. But so if you think about the state of Maine, Maine Med is a quaternary center in terms of the intensity of the resources they have. EMMC in Bangor will be a tertiary center. And then a lot of us in the secondary and primary area. So we would have
– Is Maine Med the only quad, just to kind of clarify?
Only quad in the state of Maine.
So for more advanced, you know, medical needs that may involve – I don't know if transplants fall into that or advanced cardiac needs –
Right, or it's those things that need a broader population really to support that work. So you don't have enough people in the community to really utilize that service to enable you to do it well.
Right,
and so that would be the type of services that they have. So we really made again the board leadership made the decision to take a hard look at each of those things and say, can we do it brilliantly? So, for example, radiation oncology or radiation therapy for our cancer patients, we can do very well. We have a linear accelerator, which is a really a sophisticated piece of equipment that allows us to provide that treatment. And the reasoning behind that was when people go through cancer treatments, if you can think about it, I drive up and down the highway quite a bit in my EMHS role, and I'm relatively healthy, or I think I am, and it wears me out. And if you think of someone undergoing radiation therapy, which is also debilitating, which does take a lot of energy from people, and then ask them to go up and down the highway several times a week is not the best of care. So I took a look at that and said, even though it's a huge investment for the organization, we will choose to do that. So we have those types of services. We have a dialysis center. Again, if you think of people who have to take the four-hour treatments three times a week to drive up and down to Bangor or beyond, really is a significant negative impact on their lives. And they're already, you know, impacted by their disease. And so we really serve that level geographically. We have more services probably than we would in that size of a community because of the geography.
We have Sylvia Gettman here. She's president and CEO of TAMIC, the Aroostook Medical Center. Talk about a recent event, an announcement that you made, talking about different services being offered by your hospital group. $2 million gift to TAMIC from the Next Generation Foundation, which certainly I'm sure will be well spent in providing resources. Talk about how the gift came about, and then talk a little bit about what that means to expand and provide added services for people in your community area.
Yeah, you know, we are so fortunate in Aroostook County and probably across Maine, but I'll speak to Aroostook County in that, you know, we have a lot of people who sometimes don't necessarily have a lot, but are willing to share what they have. And then we also have people who have resources and are also willing to share what they have to invest in the work that we do. And so the next generation, a gift, biggest gift we've ever gotten at the Aristic Medical Center, and so impactful. Part of it certainly to help with the, you know, the expensive medical technology that we need in the linear accelerator. The vault alone for that type of equipment is all concrete, 6 feet of concrete underground to shield it, anywhere from $2 to $3 million just for the vault to put it in. So very expensive equipment. But they saw more than that. They saw that we not only need to invest in the technology to provide the service, we need to help people pay for the services and get the support that they need in order to get back and forth. As you know, we're rural geography, transportation, overnight accommodations, maybe for their family members, help defraying the cost of some of the chemo agents that we have. Help with a navigator. You know, healthcare is so complicated. It's even those of us who work in it and have spent our careers in it find it difficult to navigate. So our ability to really have a person there to help navigate through all the insurance pieces, the referral pieces, the travel pieces, and their funding will help us do that as well. So really a thoughtful gift and one that will impact not just the patients we take care of today, but really decades of patients.
And I should know this, but maybe you can explain who is the Next Generation Foundation. Is it Maine-based or is it a national group?
They're an anonymous foundation, Next Generation. They're the next generation who had the opportunity to use their resources in an interesting way. And that's pretty much most of what I know about them.
And really, you know how, complete anonymity. Like how, you can't say, I mean, if most
I
of the
don't
gifts,
know their names.
Is it Maine-based or is it national?
I don't know that specifically. I believe they have a Maine connection because they've made several gifts throughout the state. But isn't that just a remarkable
wow.
thing to not only do that, bring that kind of generosity, but not do it for your own benefit? I think those are some remarkable people.
That is rare and certainly admirable. We have Sylvia Gettman here. She's president and CEO of TAMIC, which is the Aroostook Medical Center. Largest medical center, hospital center north of Bangor, would you say?
Yep. Certainly on our employee count, we would be.
Let's talk a little bit about healthcare here in Maine in general. So in addition to your role in terms of heading up the medical center up north, you're also part of kind of the network of healthcare providers here in Maine.
So I'm also senior vice president with EMHS, which is one of the systems. There's several of them here in the state of Maine, a very progressive system. And in that role, I actually have one of the coolest jobs ever. Well, I think my CEO role is actually a lot of fun most days. But I also have the opportunity to co-chair something called our Transformation Steering Committee for the system. And that is really looking at where is the healthcare system going, where should it go, and how do we position and transition to that future? So a lot of very interesting times in healthcare, and I have a great privilege in being able to lead some of that work.
Have you answered the rhetorical question, where is healthcare going? Can we break that as news here in WLOB?
Oh, you know, on any given day, I can probably give you an answer. Is it the same from day to day? I don't know anybody that a crystal ball would be so helpful. But certainly those of us who work in healthcare have some pretty strong feelings around where healthcare should go. And when I talk about healthcare, I really talk about patient care. So where and how should we be caring for our patients? And what do we know that can lead us to do that in a different way? Because the current system as structured doesn't work.
Well, let's talk about that in Maine. We have some challenges here in Maine. I've often talked about and discuss that one of our biggest challenges, I mean, here in Maine and around the country when it comes to big issues, social issues, healthcare issues, economic issues, we become very blame-focused on whose fault it is. I think Maine has some challenges, but at the root, I don't think it's anyone's fault. I don't think it's the current administration's fault. I look at 250 years ago, Maine was settled. Before planes, trains, automobiles, being in New England, northern state, people settled here very early on in our country's kind of evolution. And we spread out over 35,000 square miles. And It was a resource-based economy with wood, lumber, textile. The economy shifted, and now we're left with a relatively inefficient infrastructure in many areas, and one of the most profound and life-changing and life-impacting areas is healthcare, because every mile you put between a patient and patient care or healthcare, you add inefficiency, you add cost, you add there's an impact in terms of quality of service. Every mile you put between a student or a potential student in education, same thing. And every mile you put before a worker in a job. And the problem, one of the big problems we have here in Maine, in my opinion, is we have a lot of miles in between that. And being up north, is it located actually in Presque Isle or just outside of Presque Isle for Tammy?
Well, so the hospital itself is located in Presque Isle, but we also have a network of clinics. We have a long-term care facility in Mars Hill.
Right.
We have clinics in Fort Fairfield. We have a partnership in Ashland with a federally qualified health center. We have clinics in Caribou. And I'm leaving one out, but I'll think of it here in a moment.
One of the quad cities.
Yeah, exactly.
But the one of the big problems we have, I believe, is kind of the physics of both economics and healthcare and education is with time and space. And there are some particular challenges I'm sure you face in Tamek because, as you said, there's an aging population faster than the mean age in Maine, which is already kind of leading the nation. And you have a very rural environment, so there is time and expense and challenges getting health care to people. From your experience being there since 2010, mm-hmm. What challenges am I missing, and what does the forecast look like in terms of whether the population is continues to decrease? The demand for higher healthcare services and technology goes up, the economy and the population's going down, and so there must be some real challenges in your role. Everyone wants first-class healthcare, whether you live in a rural community, whether you live in downtown Portland. I believe everyone fundamentally deserves healthcare is kind of a human right. And I think I want to talk to you in a minute about the Affordable Care Act and what that means administratively. But how do you do that in a rural community when there are just certain limits to resources at the hospital and at the different clinics? There's limits in terms of whether it's technology or important MRI or CAT scan or latest technologies. You try to keep up. But what are the particular challenges being in a very rural environment trying to serve the community that you do?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was listening to your kind of perspective, and I was thinking how, in a way, it's so different than mine in that I love working in rural communities, and I love the area that we're in. And when I think about infrastructure, I guess, and it's probably why they stuck me on the transformation group, I really think that we can think of infrastructure very differently. How we deliver care is changing so dramatically. The resources and technology, small t technology, in terms of connecting people in different ways, you don't necessarily have to get on the road and drive to get information. I have my Fitbit on. Sadly, it's very low at the moment in terms of my activity today. But we know that the devices exist to connect us in really powerful ways. And so I would flip that the other way that says, in a very rural state, how do we think differently about how we deliver care to really become more efficient? And then what does that mean? Now, the sad part is you also gave me the foot in the door that said the word challenges. And I thought, how long do you have to list the challenges in working in the healthcare system? But what I do know is we have to do things differently. And that's one of the reasons you didn't ask me yet why I came to Maine, because, you know, it's so beautiful. Why would you ask me that? But one of the reasons was the remarkable group of people that I'm working with that's talking about we can't wait for someone else to solve the healthcare problem. You know what? If we're going to do this and do it right, we have to lead. And we have to lead starting now. And we have to lead now when we don't get paid to lead. And we have to provide care very differently. We've got to really put some teeth in prevention. And I can tell you, I've been in healthcare a very long time. We won't do the math because it just depresses me. But for a long time, through the managed care changes, through a lot of the sweeping changes. But this, and so when the new changes came through around accountable care organizations and everything that that means and doesn't mean, you know, I might have been a little skeptical. I wanted to see some data. I've been out there in front of people for a long time saying, we're not going to be an illness system anymore. You know what? We're going to be a healthcare system. And I believed it every time I said it. And then 3 years later, I didn't see the promise resolve. And I have to tell you, this is the first time where I've seen data, where I've seen movement that says, you know what? We can do this differently if we choose to and if people allow us to. And in terms of people allowing us to, I mean all the different federal players who continually change the rules of the game while we're in this really grand experiment called affordable care.
Speaking of preventative care, can you guess how far from where you're sitting right now you are from the largest preventative care biometric health screening company?
Well, I understand there's a mobile unit. I don't know where it's parked, though.
Oh, no, it's not a unit. It's a whole company. It's called ProAmerica Health. Yep. And we have conducted over 1 million health screenings in the last couple of years. And so that's something that, from my side of the business, as the CEO of ProAmerica Health, the landscape for many companies is changing. I think companies and major employers are looking at healthcare as not just a cost item and not just an overhead item, but for companies that are very involved and sensitive to their employees' health. And there's an economic element. More and more companies are investing in the preventative care that you talked about, fitness centers. Here at TideSmart, we've installed a wellness center and a fitness center downstairs. A lot of that has to do with human behavior and psychology. Changing it from a sick-based system where people look at healthcare as basically treatment of something as opposed to healthcare being something more, I guess, holistic in terms of your life, in terms of where you work, in terms of whether it's ergonomics and how you sit at your desk or fitness or how companies allow fitness and nutrition. You know, if companies have a cafeteria, how they incorporate thoughtfulness there. And talk a little bit about that as where healthcare in a medical center like you run, Sylvia Getman, president and CEO of TAMIC, and how the look and the feel and the shape of healthcare is, instead of just being a place where people drive up when they're sick, you're involved in the community, you're involved with companies, you're involved maybe with school systems and having – and really, you know, I saw a study recently that for every dollar of preventative care – there's an average and it's a generalization, but we can save $4 or $5 of treatment. So there's economics there. Not only is it the right thing to do, but it's kind of the smart thing. How do you see healthcare moving more in that direction, if you agree?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, that's the business we're already in. And so at EMHS, at the system, we have now almost 100,000 covered lives in this type of a model that isn't looking at episodic, charging on a per basis, but says, what is the total cost of healthcare for that individual over time? And then how do we change that? How do we change that outcome by wrapping care differently around it, people? And this isn't, these are some of the people that have had healthcare all along. These are people that have had coverage, Medicare, possibly main care or commercial plan, but haven't seen the outcomes. We have a very sick population, certainly in northern Maine, a lot of areas of the country. Sometimes six or more chronic conditions happening simultaneously in a lot of these individuals. So how do you take that and really change someone's life? And we'll talk about the prevention side because that's the easiest answer. If you don't get sick there to start with, if you do the right things, if you partner with us so that you understand even how to do that and allow us to maybe nag you a little bit because, you know, we don't always do things in our own best interest as humans. So can you work with us on that? How do we give you people to do that work that understand your specific context and are able to change behaviors in ways we haven't been able to before? And again, the exciting thing for me, one of the reasons I came to Maine and to Northern Maine is we are doing that and we have the data to prove it. And we're seeing more and more people, certainly certainly in the state and nationally interested in investing in that work.
I want to talk about health care both in Maine and a little more broadly nationally in terms of Affordable Care Act, health policy, and behavior. You mentioned something about Maine's older population or specific in your service area up north at TAMIC. I don't think I'll have the right wording for how this has been described, so this question will probably be a little clumsy. But when Affordable Care Act came out, there were a lot of critics that keyed on certain elements. One was, I think, the shorthand, kind of a negative attached description was death panels. And the general thought and the research that I've seen, and I'm sure there's a wide scope of opinions on this, that because we have the technology, both at your hospital and at Maine Med and across the country, to support and extend life, and we have medicine, we have drugs. So we've gone beyond, I think, curing or eliminating some of the root issues that normally in the past would have accelerated the kind of the continuum of life. We have technology. And since there's so much economic and financial pressure and insurance pressure and money pressure, that some stats have shown that in the last 30 days above a certain age, I'm not sure if that's in the 70s or 80s, but in the last 30 days of many patients' life, they will incur almost half of their health care costs for their whole life. The idea being when a person is in a very critical state, a critical age state, that a lot of medical care has to be given, a lot of nursing care, a lot of maybe procedural care, a lot of, and the question came up as kind of a moral argument with ACA, will the government be in a position to deny health care? And that's where kind of the death panel. And the roundabout question is, does, in your role as president, CEO, and working in partnership with your medical leadership, do you see those types of moral questions on the continuum of life and the cost and the healthcare cost, something that we should be having more public discussion about? And I'm not saying we decide it, but if hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars are being spent on the last week or two of somebody's life, and if you're that person, you're that person's family, that may be the most critical time in your life experience. So I don't want to minimize the emotional thing, but if we're talking about economics where we only have so many resources to help so many people, should that be a discussion, or do you think that it's a non-discussion, and should medical facilities do everything they can to the full extent to help people and to prolong life, whether or not it may be kind of connected to quality life?
Yeah, it's interesting. As you talk about that, I was thinking that
are you
maybe
disagree with me again, because this will be three for three if you disagree.
No, I think here's my disagreement. Yeah, hey, I didn't know we were keeping score, but I think that maybe we're asking the wrong question. Maybe the question is, how do we help families? How do we help our communities and our society have a different conversation? And I can tell you, I am a huge fan of hospice, and that sounds kind of odd, but I've certainly had the opportunity to use it. My mother was with hospice out in the Midwest for about 3 years. I can tell you it was kind of an interesting circumstance. Occasionally they said maybe she didn't get the memo, because people think that once you're in – and I can tell you people love to discharge people from hospice. You don't necessarily have to have a terminal outcome on that. But I think how do we help people get comfortable talking about death and dying? I think that's a broader conversation that we really should engage in. I tell people I would sign up for hospice today if I could, if they'd let me, because the resources that are in and around that, the reality of it is we're all dying, right?
Right.
Eventually. And so when you talk about, do those ethical moral dilemmas come up probably daily in our organization, not around economics, but around family dynamics, that said, at what point have you had the conversation, with your kids, with your family? I was a little startled. My husband Bill and I have three sons, two in Boston, and my 25-year-old, we took him out for dinner the other – actually, it was probably about 3 months ago. And he said, Mom and Dad, I have a kind of a serious question for you. And I'm like, okay. He doesn't have very many serious – is it money? Again, no, he's a good guy. And he said, well, I just want to know, do you have a living will? And I was like, what, are you afraid we're going to move in with you? Or what? But you know what? I said, gosh, what a great question to ask me. And how do we have those conversations? Because I think the bigger issue isn't necessarily are we economically investing too much at the end of life? We know we spend more than any other developed country in that last time frame. It's about how do we help people have healthy conversations around what their needs and wishes are. And I think we would be in a very different place if we could invest in those resources and people use the resources that are there to make those decisions.
But when you said we, do you mean the general we? Or is there something more specific? Because is it the healthcare industry? Is it a policy thing where government policy should create an environment where there's information? Is there – who is the we? Because I agree with you. Ironically, my son
– wait, you agreed with me there, Steve.
I've agreed with you most of the time. This is very thoughtful. This is we have Sylvia Gebman. She's president and CEO of TAMIC, the Aroostook Medical Center up north. My son coincidentally asked about the will because he was thinking – he's 14. He's already thinking he wants to get a nice car and he's like, hey, am I going to be all set? But a little different spin on your son. But I agree with you completely. We don't talk about death. I don't know if that kind of aversion comes from our kind of parochial religious base where it's kind of – you know, I grew up in an Irish Catholic family and I think a lot of people have this sense – a couple of things. One, we live in the oldest state, so we have by percentage a much higher percentage of people who are in the range where it's not just a topical discussion, it's something that is very real. And the discussion you had about hospice is something that I think is both thoughtful and compassionate, but until you just brought it up, I don't hear much dialogue about it. I don't hear it in the realm of conversation. I don't hear our state legislature. You know, we talk about, you know, the economics of how much money we're putting here or there. And we should be talking about – I just don't know how we get from the abstract of we should be doing this to the to kind of the practical part of who should be doing it. And maybe you and I can figure out something today. There could be – I mean, you're involved not only leading one of Maine's largest medical centers, but you're also play a senior role in the overall group here in Maine healthcare system. So what can we actually do to have a healthy conversation? We don't want to alarm people, but figuring out – you know, recently for 3 years I was chairman of my local town council just up the street in Yarmouth. Last year, the year before, our town manager called me up and said, we have to go out to the cold vault out in the cemetery. And I was like, what? We have a cold vault? And without going into too many of the details, we have a cemetery that was run by a separate organization. I believe it was the Catholic Church. And they weren't organized to the point where they could kind of sustain the cemetery. And we have people who have passed away from World War II, and they're, but we have a vault in Yarmouth where if people pass away in the middle of the winter and they want to be buried in a cemetery, and there's a couple places, I think, here in southern Maine where medical facilities where families have to face, you know, cold storage because you can't bury somebody in a cemetery in this type of weather. And I didn't even know our town had that. And literally, not last couple of years, there haven't been people who use that service, but recently is three or four. But we don't talk about those things because I think we want to put death as like this unhealthy conversation. But we should do more, but in a compassionate way. But how do we get there other than just, you know, the general feeling of we should have more conversations?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think you're already doing it now. You have a platform to start a comfortable conversation.
Right.
I can tell you the time to have the conversation is not when you have to have the conversation. And I think, you know, you talked about what dramas and people don't necessarily make the best decisions in a time of crisis. And I can tell you, for better, for worse, you know, everybody thinks, well, when things go bad, everybody's going to rally around and all the family's going to come together and put aside all their differences. Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. And so, again, that is not the time to make a really thoughtful, compassionate decision. So I think the more we get comfortable talking about it and understanding, when you talk about the they and the economics, for me, every they in economic has a face on it. These are people to me. These are very specific stories, whether there are employees who use our services and who come in or if they're people from the community coming in. So to me, it's a very live, compelling argument to say, let's look at each of those situations and say, have we done our best? Have we done the right things for the right reasons? Have we done what we can to support that conversation in those families?
If you wouldn't mind, in our last few minutes, talking a little bit about government policy and how that has impacted your role as president and CEO of TAMIC, the Aristic Medical Center, relative to MaineCare and the Affordable Care Act. And as a medical center, your focus is you're not run as a for-profit business. You're serving a community, and you're providing life-saving and extending, and the continuum of life from prenatal care to elder care. But the reality is that there are major changes that have occurred recently. Some people support, some people don't. But from your position as president and CEO, what is the immediate impact of the current state of the state with MaineCare? And what is your view on Affordable Care Act, on what is being done and what you would like to have done relative to being able to provide the best health care for the people you serve?
Yeah, and you can probably tell I'm a dyed-in-the-wool optimist in general, and I always believe there's a solution. But what I know is either or is not a solution. And I think especially when it comes to something as sweeping and as incredibly transformational as the Affordable Care Act, I think there are parts of it that need to be changed. I think there are parts of it that are working well. And I think we need to have a different type of dialogue on, let's talk about that. Let's really look at it with what we now know. And it was interesting, you were talking about the blame game earlier. I am not about that. I'm about how do we fix it? How do we make it better? And how do we work for the people who come to us for care? I think, unfortunately, currently in the state of Maine, we have not expanded Medicaid as envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. And we did already take the cuts to pay for that, by the way, out of the healthcare system. So we actually did that and then didn't expand. And so the result has really been on almost a tsunami. The amount of charity care that we've had to give out, people who can't afford care who are coming to us. And we care for everyone who comes to us, regardless of their ability to pay. That is our mission. That and bad debt has just soared over the past 2 years. And from a couple things. One is lack of coverage. And I think I believe passionately that people need coverage, because people without coverage don't get care till it's too late. And that's the wrong time for us to be able to help them. So I think people need to have coverage. And I think the unintended consequence, like I said, gosh, from 2012 to 2014, my charity care went up about $3 million. And if you think about it, we're a $100 million organization. That's a huge impact that we didn't anticipate and are trying very diligently to manage around.
Is that the cost of services you're providing where there is no insurance or there is no money? You're just basically providing free medical service for people in need.
Correct. And then we have probably almost as much around bad debt, people that for whatever reasons don't have the resources to pay. And that's, a lot of what you've already heard in the media, high deductible health plans, people that don't have coverage. And like I said, people putting off coverage. Interestingly enough, a lot of people trying to do the right thing. And again, I didn't have a chance to share with you, again, some of the faces that I see as I think about policy. Policy to me is personal. There was a young man who came to our emergency department not that long ago, needed an insulin shot. He came in and said, I don't have any coverage. I don't want a visit. I don't want you to bill me for the visit. I just need a shot of insulin. And so, of course, the staff there was kind of taken aback and said, well, we need to do some testing. What's your blood sugar reading? He goes, well, I don't even have a type 1 diabetic. I don't have a meter. I can't afford the meter. I can't afford the strips. Working full time in Arista mm-hmm. County. Young guy in his mid-20s. And so they're saying, well, how do you monitor your blood sugar? How are you taking care of your diabetes? He goes, well, I just wait till I don't feel good. And I can tell you, this guy's not going to make it into his 30s. That is just wrong. And so my staff, of course, went crazy. They gathered up, I think, every piece of insulin and syringe they could find anywhere and gave it to him. But that's not good care. And those are the gaps that exist out there. People not, you know, and there's always people in any system who try to abuse the system. I think that's sadly, on my negative side, part of human nature as well, but right. not that many. Most people are trying to do the right thing. They're trying to manage with the resources they have. And I really would like to be part of a system that makes that easier for them, not harder, so that we can get preventative care, so we can get them healthy, so they can have great quality of life, that they can live a good life and have a good death. I think that, you know, to me, that's the mission that I'm in, and that's something worth fighting through all the cuts that are anticipated for us.
Final question, Sylvia. Since we live in a democratic society, an electorate society, our policy and our budgets and really many of the elements that kind of govern healthcare ultimately come through policy, whether it's federal policy or whether it's state policy. How active are you and how active are other leaders in healthcare systems here in Maine with our state legislature and with our representatives to D.C.? And what can listeners do to affect change other than being frustrated with the whole system? And I've always advocated we need to get people more informed, more engaged, and more vocal, not in just writing negative letters, but being thoughtful. And the only hope for change is for the right people who are elected to office to really be thoughtful about the right policy that affects all of us, and healthcare is one of the most sensitive areas. Where do you see either your role or the future in terms of the intersection of healthcare and public policy?
Yeah, so obviously I think I have a huge responsibility, not just role, but responsibility to help people understand the impacts of policy. And so I actually serve on the Maine Hospital Association board and their policy committee. I serve on the American Hospital Association regional policy board that encompasses five New England states. And then at the local level, which is really where I think the conversation needs to and has to start, actually last week we just hosted our legislative delegation in Augusta to really sit down. We had them for breakfast. We also had an evening, the Aristic group, economic development group, hosts an evening with all of the leadership of the delegation to really help them understand some of the implications. It's so complex. It's too complex. And so I guess my hope would be that people just ask us the question and engage us in a conversation. We're such a soundbite society that, you know, it's very easy to jump to or believe in the rhetoric without asking the thoughtful question and taking the time to understand. And it's on us, though, to make it understandable because it is ridiculously complicated. And so if we could just sit down and have the conversation, you know what? I know I am committed and I've seen that we can move this in a positive direction.
Well, I'd love to have you come back, and that'll be our next subject, fixing the system. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for inviting me. My pleasure.
Nantucket's loss has been Maine's gain since you moved here in 2010. We've had Sylvia Getman. She's the president and CEO of the Roostic Medical Center. For information, if you want to see some of the background of the good work they're doing there, their website is www.tamc.org. And I think they also have a presence on Facebook. And it was a wonderful discussion, and I agree with you in terms of the elements of compassion, of doing more, and people being more active. And thank you for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 13:10 a.m., and we'll be back.